Welcome, True Believer readers, to a book battle on another episode of Let's Read Spider-Man, where we cover books from two different Spider-Man titles that came out at the same time. It's Tupac versus Biggie Smalls. We'll discuss the spectacular Spider-Man books from the fall of 1988 as Peter travels from Vegas to Texas to San Diego. Let's see which books are juicy and if any deserve some California love.
From October of 1988, Stan Lee presents Web of Spider-Man Annual 4, Sweet Poison. Written by Steve Gerber and art by Cynthia Martin. Peter is on a talk show in Miami promoting his published book of Spider-Man pictures, Webs. Five other characters are quickly introduced. High Evolutionary, for is coming after Man-Thing because he has some evolved interdimensional thing, but his eliminators, these are his exoskeleton-clad thugs, run into a being named Poison, who is a human, but also has a being from another dimension within her. She makes short work of the eliminators. The two other characters are Kingpin and Slug, a character best explained with his first dialogue.
Kingpin, I can asphyxiate a man in the folds of my flesh.
Are attempting to correct problems within their criminal organizations. Spider-Man eventually shows up. He finds some cocaine in a swamp, and the two storylines intersect with much fighting. Man-Thing survives. Poison's alternate personality goes back to its own dimension. And I guess everyone else is fine? Peter returns to his hotel to find Mary Jane Watson. Parker.
He wasn't expecting to find her either.
No, she wasn't on the tour at this point, but she flew down to Miami for him.
The alien inside Poison leaves her a small amount of superpowers so she can do stuff in the future if she ever needs to be back. There are three more sections this annual that Eddie didn't cover.
Why? There's a summary. I didn't like these other three sections. Go ahead, though.
I know, but I mean, but it's called Let's Read Spider-Man, not Let's Read the Parts of Spider-Man that Eddie likes. There's a summary of the previous year for Spider-Man, which is just filler. So there you go. See?
Thank you.
Look, that's all you have to say. That's all you have to say. A high evolutionary story and an origin story for this Cecilia Cardinale and how she became Poison. That's the only one I'm going to talk about here because I don't want to talk about the evolutionary stories either that much. She's a Cuban woman who hooked up with a Russian officer and got pregnant. They had a real relationship, but when they were found out, he claimed she seduced him and demanded money and favors, so he was able to go back to Russia, and she went to jail. She was dying in the jail, and the alien shows up, conveniently, and it needed a host, so just like the Tok'ra in Stargate, if anybody follows that analogy, they work together to keep each other alive. It's just a symbiotic relationship, let's be honest.
Right.
The little stories about her looking for, you know, her old flame, which is this Russian guy. She just doesn't find him when she's looking around for him.
Yeah, and this alternate personality or alien is what's inside her, like talks to her. She kind of thinks and talks quietly to herself all the time. And some of the other characters in the story, like on the bus, are like looking at her.
Yeah, and it's super confusing to everybody because this is her origin, and we don't know what's going on. And we're like, what's this? I'm reading this book going, I don't know what's happening for a while. But eventually you... It would have been nice to have the origin story earlier.
So then who would have thought we want an origin story in there? But we did. Well, you know, I have said this before. I love when Spider-Man's New York writers poke fun at another city. Everything about the really, really fat Slug in Miami really makes fun of Miami. And Slug, he's like the Jabba the Hutt, right?
Yes.
What's going on? Not only does he say he has asphyxiated, but he like does asphyxiate a man within the folds of his skins and then says, throw him in the pool for one last swim.
Yeah, I thought that was so stupid that
I couldn't believe it.
I'm like, this is just kind of stupid. And then he told everyone, let's get back to the party, even though I just killed a man in my fat. So I'm like,
well, thanks.
I tried to spare the listeners of that, and hopefully it doesn't happen in our next set of books, which are from November and December of 1988. Stanley presents Web of Spider-Man 44, Reunion, and The Incredible Hulk 349 Warzone, written by Peter David, art by Alex Seviuk, and penciled by Jeff Purves.
Peter is in Las Vegas promoting his book When Warzone, which is four G.I. Joe type military characters named Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta, begin a game where they try to kill or disable each other. Much fighting occurs, with Spider-Man getting confused as to who is bad or a good guy. Gray Hulk, who's supposed to be dead according to Spider-Man, shows up because the fighting hurts his lady friend and calms everyone down. Also, Hulk talks and reasons like an adult, at one point saying,
"Egad, no, I've been found out."
After much more mayhem and shooting all over Vegas, Hulk figures out everyone in Warzone are androids and rips Alpha's arms off to put an end to all fighting.
This Hulk character, we're going to call him Mr. Fix-It, by the way, too. That will mean something to people that are following the story from the Marvel Universe. And these human-looking androids, one's a girl. I appreciate that.
Right.
Apparently, they fight annually over who gets to wear a special amulet that makes them like bigger, better, faster, stronger. So that's what this is all about, too.
Yeah, I, you know, had trouble working in the plot here, because when I say there is a lot of shooting and fighting in these two books, there are arguably over 100 panels of characters doing just that. It is exhausting to read. Though I did like how Hulk, at one point, he can't get his hands on Spider-Man, and Spider-Man's like springing around him and punching him in the face, and he takes his hands and claps them together, which like sonically injures Spider-Man, and then he punches him too. As far as fights go, this is an interesting technique to when you're having problems with Spider's agility.
Speaking of agility, we're going to face a little more agile foe in our next book, which is from December of 1988. Stanley presents Web of Spider-Man 45, Death from Above, by Adam Blostein and Alex Seviak.
Peter is trying to fly out of Las Vegas on budget airline Rattlesnake with a group of goofy cowboy mobsters, but his plane is blown up by the Vulture. They all parachute to safety, and the Vulture grabs the cowboy boss and takes him to his lair. The Vulture hates this guy because he won't buy his rigged dice and stole his journals containing instructions on how to make them, but also how to make his mummification formula, which he needs to preserve his body so everyone can visit his mausoleum when he dies. Spider-Man ends up finding and fighting the Vulture in classic fashion and saves everyone. The stewardess on the plane was an undercover CID agent, and she arrests all the baddies.
So, just to make sure I understand this, Peter's flying on budget Rattlesnake Airlines, which happens to have a CID agent on it.
Yes.
And then everybody else is a bad guy. That's all that's on this plane.
Pretty much,
Criminals and a cop. Gotcha.
Yeah.
This agent, she saw Peter jump off the plane, and then when she got on the ground, she found Spider-Man later. She calls him gorgeous at one point, too, Spider-Man.
Yes, it's true.
Hopefully the CID agent is not going to check the aircraft manifest and see who the passengers are, since it's literally her, a bunch of criminals, and one person who turns out to be Spider-Man. I'm just saying.
So. We're not pointing out these inconsistencies in Peter's identity.
Oh, I'm writing that down on my notes of the pros and cons.
Oh, who knows who Spider-Man is?
No, I bet if Web of Spider-Man is better than Spectacular Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
Everybody knows who Spider-Man is. In our last podcast, we talked about Radioactive Man. He unmasked Spider-Man. We didn't even cover
it
anymore.
That's true. Who cares?
He completely unmasked him, started operating on him. He's like, I don't even, everybody knows who you are. Who cares? You said that was in New York, too. That's even more of a problem. Well, that's it for the Web of Spider-Man books with the annual and Hulk. We're now going to transition over and talk about the other books that you could have been buying at the same time in the fall of 1988. And these are the Spectacular Spider-Man books. So, Eddie, why don't you do the intro for our first of those books?
Yeah, let's see what they got. From October of 1988, Stan Lee presents The Spectacular Spider-Man 143, Deadline in Dallas, by Jerry Conway and Sal Buscema.
Peter is trying to find the Punisher. He's too late. The Punisher is in Dallas with the Persuader so he can kill the Lobo brothers. We know this from reading the previous issues or from the detailed story the Arranger tells the Kingpin, who replies to him,
"You have a pathetic fascination with detail, Arranger."
Peter learns from the television that the Punisher is in Dallas. Peter leaves a disappointed Mary Jane Watson Parker and heads off to Texas using his book Webs, here it is again, to give him a reason to be there. After checking out the Dallas Nutcracker, he saves the Loba brothers, and the Punisher breaks the spell of the Persuader and then puts a bullet in his heart, racking up the Punisher's at least, I don't know, 10th murder in this book. Also in this issue, Gwen Stacy's clone evades the High Evolutionary Soldiers for a second time as she heads from Ohio towards New York.
Ooh, Gwen getting closer. You know, this Punisher, it's interesting because the Persuader has been forced to persuade the Punisher to do the bidding of the Arranger and Kingpin. But at one point, the Persuader's like, I'm kind of getting used to this and like it. And the Punisher also, the only reason he kind of breaks the Persuader's persuading is because he does something that he doesn't want to do, which is kill Spider-Man. And that's what, like, he stops. And he says, those other things that you made me do, I probably would have done those anyways. So that's why I wasn't trying too hard to, like, get out of your persuading. But at the end of this book, like you said, James B., Gwen Stacy is getting closer to New York. Let's see if she makes it there from November and December of 1988. Stanley presents the Spectacular Spider-Man 144 and 145, An Ill Win and The Boomerang Return by Jerry Conway and Sal Buscema.
Well, Eddie, we're going to have to wait a while because it's another book with another non-New York City location.
Ooh.
This time Peter's in San Diego, promoting Webs. While on a talk show, Peter meets pompous Louis Baxter III, the America Cup sailing sailboat racer, who is promoting himself when the Australian supervillain loosely used, Boomerang, is seen trying to blow up the American racing yacht. Peter assumes that it's an Australian attempt against Baxter and the U.S., but later, when both sailboat racers are together, Boomerang kills the Aussie captain, Artie Critton, which confuses our webbed hero. Spider-Man correctly figures it out, and Boomerang and the cheating sailboat captain who hired him, Louis Baxter III, both get what was coming to them. Also in these books, MJ's niece shows up for a visit, and Joe Robbie hobbles back to work, only to be arrested for not revealing Tombstone's murder that Joe Robbie witnessed 20 years ago.
Oh, Joe Robbie. Poor guy. But this whole Australian supervillain, first of all, it does make sense, I guess, to have Boomerang being Australian because he's throwing boomerangs, which are, like, you know, from Aboriginal Australians, technically. I never thought I would be reading a yachting race and someone trying to destroy another yacht in a Spider-Man book, but that's what we got in this one. Now, James B., let's see if we see Gwen Stacy again. From November of 1988, Stanley presents the Spectacular Spider-Man Annual 8, Return to Sender by Conway, Bagley, and Williams.
Yeah, Gwen Stacy's on the cover of this book.
Ha-ha!
In this Evolutionary War annual, which we had one a little while ago, we discussed with Web of Spider-Man Annual 4, another Evolutionary War. That's the storyline through all the books that they're ruining these annuals with this time of year. The High Evolutionary is after the Gwen Stacy clone. Half this book is about the High Evolutionary stuff and the Young Gods, but guess what? I'm only going to focus on the Gwen Stacy part. Peter tells MJ he saw Gwen being attacked by these soldiers and she got away. MJ is kind of only worried about how Peter feels about Gwen. Eventually, Gwen and Spider-Man end up mixed up in some High Evolutionary nonsense, and it's revealed she wasn't a clone, but another person who was kidnapped and then given gene therapy so she looks like Gwen Stacy, and the High Evolutionary lets them go, and one of those Young God people fixes her look so she looks like she's supposed to look again.
Of course.
There are two stories in this book that focus on the High Evolutionary and the Young Gods. They each get an entire story, but there's no Spider-Man, so there you go.
I 100% approve of you not talking about the Young Gods, James B.
All right. Do you want to talk a little bit about this book before we break down the two sets of books, or do you want to save it?
Let's save it and hear from our sponsors, right? There's got to be a sponsor for this episode.
We got two sponsors because we covered two sets of books.
Ooh. Are they like competing with each other? Should we see like which one the listeners like more?
I don't think that's the intent of sponsors. Like when you watch commercials, I don't know if you're supposed to say to your friends and family which commercial you like better. But you know what, Eddie? Sure. At the end of this, why don't you just let us know which one you prefer?
Yes. All right. I'm sure I will prefer one over the other.
Listeners, Rattlesnake Airlines has discounts for Western-themed mobsters. Now, 33 inches of legroom for coach seats. Earn 2,000 miles for your first car rental through Turo if you fly Rattlesnake Airlines. Let's Read Spider-Man is also sponsored by Dr. Warren's Gene Therapy. Don't like who you are, we can fix that. With gene therapy, we can change your look and also your memories. We'd love to tell you how that works, but just trust us, it does. Get it at your Rite Aid and your local Walgreens. Must be 10 years or older to use. Dr. Warren's Gene Therapy.
Well, now I know we've had Latvian Airlines before on our show. Rattlesnake Airlines? I don't know if they're much better. But this gene therapy seems like it could help out a lot of people.
There you go. Glad you approve. So, Eddie, you want to talk about these books?
Yeah, let's do it.
That's what we do. There's eight of them.
So many books, James B.
And those annuals are long. You know, the annual four, which had Poison in it,
yes.
Eddie, I noticed it had a lot of G.I. Joe TV show references in it.
Yes, it did, didn't it?
Listeners, if you did not know this, G.I. Joe is literally a TV show created to sell the toys. Marvel Comics was picked up into the, you know, the whole mix later at some point. And I wanted to say that in these actual Web of Spider-Man issues, there is an ad for G.I. Joe action figures. And William the Refrigerator Perry, the famous defensive player from the Chicago Bears, is a G.I. Joe action figure.
Interesting, James B. You know, it was good to see the Vulture. He's one of Spider-Man's oldest villains. I gotta say, though, it's super sad to see that they are continuing this plot line that the Vulture is trying to sell rigged dice to a casino. This has already happened once when he was in Atlantic City and he found himself in a lot of trouble. And they're also continuing the idea that he wants to, like, mummify himself and make a magnificent tomb so everyone can see him in his afterlife. The cover of the Vulture's book is my favorite cover out of all eight books.
One of the books we covered today was Hulk 349, and I don't like when we go to a different story because then I kind of feel like, what's going on with the Hulk plot line? You know, it was Dr. Doom was at the end of the book, and I'm like, do I want to go over there and check out what happens? You know what? Dr. Doom's not in the next Hulk book because the storyline heads over to Fantastic Four book 320. So all the Web of Spider-Man books we covered today all crossed over to another book outside of Spider-Man. Also, fun fact about these Hulk books, you might notice the number 349, it's like higher than Spider-Man. That's because Hulk went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then Eddie, Hulk just stopped. And then they came back later with Tales of Astonish 102 and said, you know what, we're going to rename Tales of Astonish just Hulk. So Hulk's numbering goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then it goes like 102, 103.
Wow, super fascinating, James B. I did not know that. I told you that there was a ton of fighting with the Warzone trio in Las Vegas. They are destroying and disrupting everything. Within there, like you were saying, Gray Hulk is there. And it is intriguing to see him. But in the same way, James B., I didn't try to look up why Gray Hulk is gray and not green anymore. Because Spider-Man was very startled to see Hulk at all. He thought he was dead. And, you know, he was in disguise, too, as Mr. Fix-It. Nobody knew he was actually the Hulk until Spider-Man exposed him.
If I don't say this next thing to you, Eddie, I'm going to get some kind of email from one of our listeners because, as I pointed out, every single one of our listeners knows more about Spider-Man than we do, because we're still in 1988, and they're all like, yeah, I've read all these books a long time ago, guys. So in the Web of Spider-Man High Evolutionary Annual, there are two additional stories, which, you know, you said, like, whatever, I'm not going to talk about them. But they involve Jessica Drew as a teenager and Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch when they're babies. Yes. It's probably very important to the Marvel timeline, or it's some kind of ridiculous retcon that doesn't, you know, have to deal with Spider-Man. But I have to acknowledge at least that these stories are there, and I'm sure they're important, and somebody will tell us later why. But I don't need to know why. Don't send me an email. Wait, send me an email. I like emails. Send me an email about something else, please. Go ahead, Andy.
Would you like to know how you could send us an email to James Tweed? You could send an email to letsreadspiderman@gmail.com, or you click on the link to our social media down below in this podcast description.
Eddie, that was like your best segue ever. I'm so proud of you.
Every once in a while it happens, James B.
And now it's time for the close. I'm James B, joined by
Eddie.
And now it's time for the best books I read today.
You know, James B, I really enjoy Peter Parker and Spider-Man moving all over the country to these different cities. It gives them a good chance to reach out to a lot of different people and experience and experiment with, like, the writing that's going on. As much as I really enjoyed The Kingpin and The Punisher and The Persuader and The Spectaculars, having Peter and Spider-Man deal with the yacht guy and then this whole evolutionary story with fake Gwen Stacy and Young Gods, who neither of us cared about at all, makes me like reading the goofy web books. At least we get a new character who's pretty interesting with Poison and silly writing in Miami. While, yes, Spider-Man crosses over into Hulk and it gets a little silly there, but we see the Vulture. And the Vulture is one of Spider-Man's oldest villains. And we know him and, quite frankly, love him. So for me, the web books.
Eddie, the web main annual story is less interesting than the one in the Spectacular's annual story, for sure. But the other two stories in web are way better. I call the annuals even to me. I think the Web of Spider-Man stories overall, like you mentioned, the yacht story and the Rattlesnake Airlines and all that stuff, they're just silly and forgetful. Mary Jane is the only supporting character, although I really do enjoy Vulture and Mr. Fix-It. The Punisher and Boomerang are not as good as the Hulk and the Vulture, but the plot of these stories is just a little better. And the Spectacular Spider-Man stories have Joe Robbie and Jonah as well as MJ. So for me, Spectacular Spider-Man wins.
Thanks, James B. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Eddie, did you see Spider-Man swings in at the beginning of the book and says, "Yabba dabba do"?
I did not see that. This
do you know what that is from?
This is, wait, Yogi the Bear? No? Flintstones?
It's Flintstones.
Thank you. That's what it is. Sorry.
At one point, one of Spider-Man's quips is, "I heard Dr. Octopus is teaching a course called Supervillain Pros 101.
I would take that class in a heartbeat.
I like that he has Dr. Octopus teaching it, too.
Not Doc Ock. His full name was used.
Correct. Yeah, I was typing some notes, and it does say supervillain pros, and it does talk about that the Boomerang is a supervillain. I guess if you are not a regular villain, if you have a costume, you're just inherently a super villain, like the way superhero, right?
Is Kingpin a supervillain then?
Or is he nope.
Not? He's not, right?
I don't think so. He's just a villain.
Just
right?
A fat guy. I mean, muscle fat guy.
If you're not in a costume, right? I think you're not a supervillain.
Wow.
Maybe he could be like a big time villain or an arch villain.
Right.
Or the ultimate villain, but I don't think you're super. Unless he's got some, we haven't learned about this yet, some powers, you know, he's got an exoskeleton made out of steel from when he was a baby or something, you know. I don't think he's a supervillain.
All right. Boomerang, supervillain.
When do you think America lost the America's Cup?
Fairly recently, and they had it for a really long time too. I've actually watched these races with my dad.
You don't think they lost it in the '80s?
No, I don't think so.
I think you're wrong. I think they lose. I thought they lost it around here, and that's why
they made a book about this.
That's why it came up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, we gotta Google it right now while you're on the show. If you can Google it, I'll just edit it out. Listeners want to know.
Uh-oh. 1983. They defended the cup for 132 years in a row.
Right. Right.
Wow.
It was a two-team race, though, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if I can remember. I haven't watched one of them in a long time, but I have watched.
I think it's only two teams, but it's not like the Olympics where there's all these different people.
Don't have a whole bunch of boats sailing at the same time.
And they don't even race every year, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either.
I feel like every 4 years they race once. It's like, so that might not be this big a deal as we think. It may have been like 33 races in a row.
It is incredible to watch them if you have a chance.